Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin on a day when the Trump administration's travel ban was again struck down by the Federal Appeals Court, with more trouble for him looming on the legal front from lawsuits the attorneys general of the District of Columbia and Maryland filed alleging that Trump has violated Article 1 of the Constitution, known as the Foreign Emoluments Clause. Leah Littman, a professor at the University of California Irvine School of Law, who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy and writes for the TakeCareBlog.com, where she has an article, States and the Emoluments Clause, joins us to discuss a new theory of standing into emoluments litigation. Since Maryland is not a private litigant but a state, they are putting forward the argument that the president's violation of the emoluments clauses is violating the terms under which Maryland surrendered some of its powers over foreign affairs to the federal government, and that they have suffered harm to their sovereign and quasi-sovereign interests. Then we will speak with Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, about his article at CNN, Democrats Take Your Cues from Bernie Sanders, and discuss the warning Sanders issued to the Democratic establishment on Saturday at a meeting of progressive activists in Chicago that, quote, Trump did not win the election, the Democratic Party lost the election. We will look into whether the Democrats can seize the great opportunity they have for 2018 as Trump is consumed by growing scandals and the Republicans are getting little done in a Congress they control except for harmful and unpopular legislation. And finally, we'll examine analogies between today and the America of the 1850s, when the vehemently anti-immigrant Know-Nothing movement was a national political force, just as Trump's Tea Party Republican base is today, and speak with Sidney Blumenthal, a former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton. He is the author of a new book just out, Wrestling with His Angel, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 2, 1849 to 1856. And we will discuss how the House divided against itself then over half slave and half free is now divided between half educated and half fact free. And joining us now is Leah Littman, who's an assistant professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, where she researches and writes on constitutional law with a particular focus on federalism and federal post-conviction review. She clerked for Justice Anthony M. Kennedy of the United States Supreme Court, and she blogs at TakeCareBlog.com, where she has an article, States and the Emoluments Clause. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leah Littman.
Thank you for having me.
And today, the Attorney Generals of Maryland, that's Carl Racine, and Attorney General of Washington, D.C., Brian Froesch, essentially have sued Donald Trump under the Emoluments Clause because of his ownership of a hotel in Washington, D.C. that does a lot of business with foreign visitors. This is not the first of the suits filed against Donald Trump. The first was filed in January by Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, D.C. And, of course, a D.C. restaurant also sued in March because of unfair competition from this hotel of Trump's, the Trump International Hotel in D.C., arguing they benefit from an unfair advantage because of its close association with the president. So what's your sense then of whether or not the courts will take this up?
So I think that the D.C. and Maryland case that was just filed today, they make some very compelling allegations for why they have standing to hear this claim. So before a federal court can hear the argument that the president's financial arrangements violate the Emoluments Clause, before a federal court can determine that, the court has to ascertain that the plaintiffs who brought the suit have standing to raise that claim, that they've been injured and that that injury is caused by the government conduct they're complaining of, and that a favorable judicial decision would redress their injury. And Maryland and D.C., as you were noting, make some compelling allegations for why the president's violations of the Emoluments Clause injure them. Among other things, because Maryland as a state gave up some power and sovereignty over foreign affairs in ratifying the Constitution. Maryland has the expectation, which the Constitution protects, that the federal government, including the president, will exercise the power over foreign affairs in accordance with the terms that Maryland agreed to when it became a part of the United States. And even apart from that injury, Maryland says that the president has bragged that he has been able to secure favorable treatment for his businesses from governments by wielding his political and financial clout. And Maryland says, well, that deprives us of effective enforcement of our laws and of resources. And on top of that, Maryland operates hotels that compete with the president's. And again, the president's, you know, added boost of branding his hotels and using his position as president to brand his hotels and restaurants, that places Maryland's hotels at a competitive disadvantage.
Well, I can't imagine anybody believes that there is a real firewall between Donald Trump and his sons. That's the rubric under which Trump has maintains ownership of his holdings, but he's saying that I'm in a blind trust because I'm no longer a hands-on CEO. My sons are taking care of it, and that begs the question: do you mean when you have dinner with your sons, you don't talk about business?
Yes, that's among the questions that the current situation raises. I'd put some others on the table. You know, it's a blind trust, but the president still receives reports about his businesses. On top of that, his sons brag about their influence over their president and, you know, make political statements and statements about his administration. And, you know, he's included some of his children in the administration. And, you know, they promise that he will appear at his hotels and restaurants. So, you know, even if there's some kind of separation, you know, he is still blurring the distinction between his persona as a businessman and his persona as president in so many different ways.
Well, it trickles down to the son-in-law's own sister, who used their connections to Trump in China to get a bunch of Chinese investors promising green cards if they invest in the Kushner's properties. So this is a pretty extraordinary situation. It doesn't seem like Donald Trump has done anything resembling what previous presidents have done. Is that fair?
I think that that's a reasonable characterization of how the president has structured his both his financial affairs and his political affairs, you know, relying on his family that are enmeshed in his businesses and, you know, advertising his businesses with his position as president. No, I don't think that there's been anything like this.
So explain to us then why you think that this route to get standing, this new theory of standing from the Attorneys General of the State of Maryland and the District of Columbia has merit.
Sure. So I would start with the idea that the Supreme Court has reaffirmed that states have an easier time establishing standing and getting into federal court than private litigants do. So the Supreme Court has said, you know, the normal rules for standing are more relaxed when a state wants to bring a challenge in federal court. And in particular, they're more relaxed when the state tries to assert sovereign interests or quasi-sovereign interests. And in Maryland and D.C.'s complaint are allegations for why the president's violations of the Emoluments Clause hurt their sovereign and quasi-sovereign interests, specifically interests that they ceded when they joined the United States by giving up power over foreign affairs to the federal government. On top of that, there's, you know, it also hurts Maryland and D.C.'s interest in the enforcement of their own laws. If they can't maintain an effective enforcement policy and enforce laws uniformly against the president who's using his financial and political clout to secure exactions from them. And on top of that, there's also a concern that Maryland and D.C. are having to compete with other foreign and state officials to curry favor with the president, and that, too, drains their sovereign and quasi-sovereign resources and interests. So those are the kinds of interests that the Supreme Court has said in Massachusetts versus EPA get some additional solicitude in federal court. And so they have, you know, some cases that suggest they can get into federal court more easily than private litigants, and some good arguments for why the president's violations of the Emoluments Clause injure them.
And, of course, we're talking about this case that's brought by the Attorney General of Maryland and D.C. to sue Donald Trump via the Emoluments Clause on the very day that, yet again, the travel ban has been struck down by the Ninth Circuit in California. That would indicate to me, at least, let me ask you this, is the Ninth Circuit decision striking down the travel ban yet again because of what Donald Trump says and does in public? Because it would seem to me that if this emoluments case goes forward, you could surely make an argument that Donald Trump's treatment, for example, in foreign policy of some of these disgusting despots like Erdogan in Turkey and Duterte in the Philippines seems to have something to do with these financial holdings in the case of the hotels in Manila and of the hotels in Istanbul, which some of Erdogan's cronies are invested in.
Yes. No, I think that the plaintiffs in several emoluments, or several of the plaintiffs in the emoluments lawsuits, have made allegations that suggest the president's financial interests have shaped some of the decisions he has made as president. For example, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington pointed out that the scope of the president's travel ban is affected by the fact that he has financial interests in some of the countries that aren't subject to the travel ban. And on top of that, there was a report today, I think, about how the administration, including the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, may have been angry at Qatar because Qatar refused them favorable financial deals. And there's also evidence of Saudi Arabia giving a ton of money to the president's hotels and restaurants and, you know, patronizing them. So, yes, there are very real concerns about how the president's financial interests are influencing his foreign policy, which is part of what makes his current financial arrangements so scary. We don't really know when he's acting as president in the interests of the United States or when he is acting for his own self-enriching interests. And, you know, you had mentioned the Ninth Circuit opinion and whether it relied on the president's public statements. The Ninth Circuit actually invalidated or upheld a preliminary injunction saying that the entry ban was likely invalid on statutory grounds. So it said the president had just exceeded his authority under congressional statutes. And in only one small portion of the opinion did the court rely on anything the president had said in public about the entry ban beyond what the order itself said.
Well, he's got this attorney now in the White House who seems to have made the White House counsel all but irrelevant. And my understanding is that he approached some of the big law firms in Washington, D.C. for some of the heavyweight lawyers in D.C. used to dealing with these matters that he's facing, and he was turned down largely because he doesn't pay his legal bills. At least that's the understanding I have.
Yes, I've seen those reports as well. You know, I obviously have no knowledge into whether or not they're correct. But yes, his personal lawyer, there was also a report that his personal lawyer has been, you know, advising some of the officials in the White House, both not to talk about the Russia-related investigation and also that they need not hire lawyers. And that itself seems very inappropriate for the lawyer that serves Trump in his personal capacity to be injecting himself into the official business of the White House and, you know, advising people who aren't his clients about what they should do.
Well, this lawyer also happens to represent Russia's biggest state bank that is under sanctions and also represents one of Putin's closest friends, this oligarch, Dapasha. So there again, the Russian thing, the entanglement, revisits us. It's extraordinary.
It is. And the administration is not doing itself any favors. you know, and how it's conducting itself, either removing the specter of potential Russian interference in the election or potential indebtedness to Russia by not disclosing the president's tax returns, and also not doing anything to assuage any of the concerns about the president's financial arrangements.
Well, just in the last minute or so, the case that I mentioned that was the first one to be filed back in March by the restaurant that's claiming unfair advantage because it's close to the hotel, and the hotel, of course, gets a lot of traffic because people can, you know, give Donald Trump money. And this is a guy that's easily flattered by both by praise and by emoluments.
Yeah.
to use an antiquated term. So give us an idea of where you think that one's going to also make its way, along with you suggested to us that the Attorneys General of D.C. and Maryland actually have an interesting and potentially useful standing case. But how about the others?
Sure. So, you know, I should note with the caveat that standing doctrine of, you know, among all of the doctrines of constitutional law is one of the more amorphous and perhaps malleable, so it's difficult to predict with a ton of certainty what will happen in any of these individual cases. That being said, I think that the plaintiffs that the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington added in their first and second amended complaints are the kinds of plaintiffs that the Supreme Court has said have standing, namely competitors to the person who, you know, they are complaining about. So here, the new plaintiffs are restaurant and hotel business persons or businesses who are saying they compete with the president's businesses and the president's using his office to promote his businesses and potential interest in his businesses that could be, you know, used by foreign and state officials to curry favor with the president. All of that is bolstering the president's competitive advantage over his businesses vis-a-vis the plaintiffs who compete with them. In several cases, the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts have said that a competitor, someone who competes with an entity in the same market as them, has standing to challenge any competitive advantage given to their competitor or whatnot. And here the plaintiffs are making that allegation. So I think that they have a good argument for standing, but it's difficult to say for sure what's going to happen.
Well, Leah Littman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Leah Littman, who's an assistant professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, where she researches and writes on constitutional law with a particular focus on federalism and federal post-conviction review. She clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy of the Supreme Court of the United States, and she blogs at takecareblog.com, where she has an article, States and the Emoluments Clause. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing Bernie Sanders' warning to the Democratic establishment that Trump did not win the election. The Democratic Party lost the election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, Democrats Take Your Cues from Bernie Sanders. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And over the weekend on Saturday in Chicago, Bernie Sanders headlined a rally of progressives looking ahead to the 2018 elections. And he made a very strong statement, which I think resonates. As he says, "I'm often asked by the media and others, how did it come about that Donald Trump, the most unpopular presidential candidate in the modern history of our country, won the election? My answer is that Trump didn't win the election. The Democratic Party lost the election." I frankly think that's pretty clear, isn't it, Julian Zelizer?
Yeah, it's a very important point that many Democrats don't focus on, either because they are so consumed naturally by what President Trump is doing, or they are focused on, you know, what might have gone wrong in terms of James Comey releasing the news about the email investigation. The question that's harder to ask is what's wrong with the party itself, and what steps has the party taken that moved it in the wrong direction? And I really think for the party to rebuild itself over the long term, this will be essential, both politically, but also in terms of policy.
So it seems that we have a situation where you have, based upon what happened the day after Trump's inauguration, millions of women showed up across the country and around the world, and it was an extraordinary manifestation of political energy and protest. It seems that we are in a situation where you have political passion and energy in search of direction. And I suppose if I were a political operative on the Democratic Party, given their perennial problem, particularly in midterm elections, which is to get Democrats to show up at the polls, President Obama said once that the Democrats seem to be genetically incapable of showing up for midterms. I suppose having political energy is something to build on, isn't it? I mean, aren't they lucky to have that? I mean, that's been lacking, hasn't it?
No, absolutely. I think one phenomenon people talk about is that Republicans often play to their base and Democrats run away from it. And there's been a lot of energy that we've seen really before President Trump. I mean, you saw that with the Sanders campaign. You've seen it with different social movements from Occupy to the Black Lives Matter movement. And often I think elected officials in the party are reluctant to embrace those elements as part of the Democratic Party. But it's exactly that kind of energy which can translate into real electoral success. Those are the people who will come out to vote and bring others to vote. And so I think Democrats need to rethink some of their strategy where they basically distance themselves from these parts of the political spectrum, which would be very beneficial and are certainly important when taking on a president of this sort who's really challenging fundamental aspects of the Democratic agenda.
Well, one of these extraordinary things about Bernie Sanders is that he's as far to the left as the Democrats have anybody, and he's not even a Democrat. He's a Democratic Socialist. And yet, Fox did a poll and found that he's the most popular politician in the United States. And there have been also the sociologists who did that really interesting book, Strangers in Their Own Land, about people down in Louisiana supporting Trump. Yet the one politician on the other side that they respect and like is Bernie Sanders. So surely the Democrats can learn from what it is about him. They seem to be so frightened about offending their donor base that they're afraid of grassroots political passions. Yet you have in Bernie Sanders somebody that's certainly not friendly towards Wall Street, but the people that used to vote Democrat, the FDR coalition who now vote Republican, they like him. So isn't there a lesson to be learned there?
Absolutely. I think I would add that Democrats partially don't want to offend their donor base. They're also still living in some ways from the shock and awe of the 1980 election of Ronald Reagan, where there is this feeling that the country has moved very far to the right. And the only way for a Democrat to survive is to mimic a lot of the rhetoric that Republicans put forth. And I think there were important lessons from Sanders' success in the primary One was more stylistic. I think people did like the directness and the bluntness of his rhetoric. But equally important was, even though he is a democratic socialist, in many ways I thought he ran like a traditional New Deal Democrat. He focused on key economic issues facing the middle class. He defended the use of government as part of the way in which the middle class can recover from the kind of conditions many people now live in on a regular basis. And it was possible to attack issues such as inequality or excessive concentrated wealth and to be very popular. And I think his success is something that's kind of, everyone's moved beyond that, but there were very important lessons for Democrats about what is too far left in 2017 and what kinds of issues might actually be much more popular and broad-based than people think. And we even saw, you know, Donald Trump as candidate capitalize on some of this. And Democrats might have lost some of those votes by moving too far to the center on economic issues, not being too far to the left.
Well, the argument is, of course, that for Democrats in purple states, that they have to sort of move to the center. That's the Manchin argument in West Virginia. To some extent, it's playing out in the John Ossoff race down there in Georgia, is it not? So how can the Democrats reconcile between the idea that they've gone too far into the political correctness, if you will, of identity politics and not focused on bread and butter issues that they have in common with the white working class voters who have defected to the Republicans?
I think they can actually deal with a wide array of issues where they can find appeal even in those purple states on what on the issues that are often called identity politics. I actually think there's many programs and policies that fall under that rubric, which have a lot of appeal to many middle-class Americans, such as gender equity in the workplace. Working-class women have always been at the forefront of workplace politics, and there's no reason to think that wouldn't have great appeal. And on economic issues, it's possible for Democrats, they've done this before, to insist on a more robust set of economic policies that props up the middle class without being seen as a socialist. So whether you're talking about free university education for Americans who are under a certain income, as was just put into effect in New York State, or whether talking about expanding Medicaid or other kinds of workplace protections, those are policies that don't really come out of the socialist tradition. They come out of the Democratic tradition. And so I think Sanders, in his 2017 incarnation, is saying Democrats just have to actually be true to some of those traditions rather than trying to run away from them.
And what do you think about the field of national security that the Republicans have simply abandoned? It's absolutely mind-boggling that the Republicans, who were always the Cold Warriors during the Cold War and the Red Baiters during the McCarthy era, are in effect making excuses for Putin or ignoring what James Comey said in his testimony the other day, that the Russians have done this, they're coming again. And Comey himself doesn't understand why the government, and he pointed out that Trump has shown no interest in even dealing with what happened in terms of Russian interference in our elections. So isn't that a massive blind spot that the Republicans have exhibited in terms of national security? Not to suggest that you need to revive the Cold War or any kind of anti-Russian rhetoric, but surely you can't just let Putin get away with it.
It's rather stunning. I think we saw a little bit of this when George W. Bush was president, and as a result of the war in Iraq, the quote-unquote national security advantage that Republicans had over Democrats started to erode, as many Americans questioned just how competent Republicans are in handling these questions. And I think right now there's a similar opportunity for Democrats to step into the area of international relations and national security with a president who is taking some pretty dramatic steps. I mean, one that you didn't mention is simply severely weakening our strongest ally alliances in Western Europe through controversial statements and a kind of aggressive interaction with members of NATO. And we have this case with Russia where you don't have to be a Cold Warrior or a McCarthyite to say that massive intervention into the election to sway the electorate toward one candidate is a fundamental threat to the democratic processes. And he has not responded to this. He has not taken it very seriously in public. And he's been actually dismissive of the whole issue as some kind of excuse of Democrats to explain the election. So like the economic issues that are out there and that are ripe for Democrats to say we can do a lot better than this administration, I think there's also this same opportunity on national security. And I think that's where this Russia scandal is not simply about the scandal and the future of the Trump presidency, but also about which party actually has a more robust and vigorous commitment to ensuring that these kinds of national security threats don't continue.
Well, it's been, unfortunately, a characteristic of the Democrats for decades that they tend to run against something rather than run for something. And at the end of the day, so often the best argument is, oh, you got to vote for us because of the Supreme Court. Well, look what's happened with the Supreme Court. So it seems to me that relying, and this is what Bernie Sanders is worried about, just relying on the fact that, that Trump is so terrible is not sufficient. So how do you capitalize on how terrible he is without relying on it? In other words, it seems that he's vulnerable even with his own supporters because of his lack of dignity. And now that you've got these emoluments cases coming forth, which we also covering on the program today. And on the other hand, you just got the simple fact of the terrible stuff that he's doing in terms of he's not a president who has brought anything to the table in terms of anything constructive. He's just torn down what exists and not replace it with anything. He's a destroyer.
I think you have to do both. I think it would be an equally big mistake for Democrats to ignore and sit silently while watching all these problems unfold, from the potential abuse of power to the conflict of interest problems that are now being raised in the courts. And Democrats have to be forceful and they have to be vigorous on that. But at the same time, they can't let that subsume their own agenda. And, you know, a model that they never would think of looking to might be Newt Gingrich and the Republicans in 94, who simultaneously ran against Bill Clinton and, you know, targeted him for his health care program, but at the same time laid out their contract with America and a set of governing principles for the Republican Party. I think that's where the midterms of 2018 are important, not simply to regaining control of the House and possibly the Senate, but starting to lay out an agenda that would be at the core of 2020. And so they do have to fight this political battle on both fronts.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, Julian Salazar, do you think, for example, they could embrace something like single payer because of its logic, that it makes sense economically? In other words, take on some of these issues that are normally dismissed by the other side as being socialism, when in fact you can make the argument that they're actually better for American capitalism, that we are heading into a kind of plutocratic form of capitalism that's not necessarily healthy, and that a lot of big corporations would be hugely relieved to not have to spend so much on healthcare costs, which are out of control. And isn't there an argument to be made there? In other words, the one thing about Sanders is that he's made it clear that you don't have to apologize for government programs. You know, you should make the argument not about big government being too big, but making government work, making government better, not too big.
Well, I think that's right. And I think when you are too apologetic, you lose the argument to begin with. I think there's a lot of areas policy right now, where there seems to be a window to push for programs that are more robust than Democrats thought was possible. So health care, and I don't know what you call it, if you call it single payer or you call it Medicare for all or Medicaid for all, there's clearly interest and support out there for something different than the ACA, but that isn't just a return to private markets. Infrastructure is another example where President Trump made a promise that he's not fulfilling, but many of his supporters wanted something like that, some kind of public works programs. And I think Democrats have a chance to show they are actually willing to do something on this, where the president himself has been very reluctant, if not uninterested, in doing so. And finally, the education agenda that Sanders ran on, it was very popular. And now you see in certain states, including Cuomo in New York, they're moving forward with this. And so I think there's many areas where you can learn from the election that what seems politically impossible is actually incredibly attractive to many Americans, and Democrats can't start with an apology. They have to start with this new promise.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. His books include Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, Democrats Take Your Cues from Bernie Sanders. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining analogies between today and the America of the 1850s when the vehemently anti-immigrant Know-Nothing movement was a national political force. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sidney Blumenthal, the former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and a senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. He has been a national staff reporter for The Washington Post, Washington editor and staff writer for The New Yorker, and his books include the best-selling The Clinton Wars, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, and The Permanent Campaign. Among his films, he was executive producer of the award-winning and Emmy-winning Taxi to the Dark Side, and his latest book just out is Wrestling with His Angel, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 2, 1849 to 1856. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sidney Blumenthal.
Glad to be here.
And this book, I guess, is about this is the second of four volumes that you're writing on Abraham Lincoln, and it's the period which I guess you describe as the interregnum. Is that where he's sort of the mainstream political parties, at least the one that he belongs to, the Whigs, are in decline, the Know-Nothings are on the rise, his Democratic rival is a rising star, and he's stuck back in his law practice ruminating. Is that...
It's an interregnum, but that gives the idea that somehow he's in purgatory. But he's really not waiting. He's forming himself. This is a decisive period for Lincoln. He's watching the world around him, and the world comes apart, and he enters into a politics of total chaos. His own party disintegrates beneath his feet. They're the rise of movements. They rush across the landscape, pro-slavery, anti-slavery, against immigration. The Know-Nothings arise, have more than a million members, a platform that says only native-born Protestants should hold public office in the United States. And Lincoln, who has served in one term in the Congress, come back to his law office in Springfield, wonders how can he change the world? What can he do in this situation at all? In the beginning, seems dead to him, then chaotic, and finally he comes to his cause against the extension of slavery and rises to the occasion.
So let's start when the book starts in 1849, and there's so much of the history that you brought forth here, Sandy Blumenthal, that has such uncanny echoes of the present. He's first having to essentially try and save his wife's family fortune from the leader of this pro-slavery movement in Kentucky, and that's when he really is, in a deeply personal way, is faced with the growing strength of the pro-slavery movement and its political and economic and social ties. And that leads him to the conclusion, as he says, can we as a nation continue together permanently forever, half slave and half free? It feels like we have a different challenge today, but equally portentous, and that is, you know, how can we, with this sort of neo-know-nothing movement that's operating now in support of Donald Trump, that how can we as a nation, since there's no consensus anymore about what is true and what is real, how can we as a nation continue to be half-educated and half-ignorant?
Well, you point to this incredible case that's been largely overlooked in Lincoln's life. It's called the Todd Ayers case. He returns to Kentucky in 1849. He's sent there by his wife to reclaim the family fortune, Todd family fortune. He loses the case, he loses the fortune, and while he's there, he watches the pro-slavery movements basically take over the state of Kentucky and destroy the moderate legacy of Henry Clay, who was his idol, and the legacy of Henry Clay's close ally and business partner, Mary Todd Lincoln's father, John S. Todd, who has died. Lincoln is in Kentucky, losing the case, while the pro-slavery people have staged a state constitution and created a new one in which they opened the slave trade in Kentucky in a way it hadn't been before. It's like watching the rise of the right wing. This is an oligarchic movement with populist appeal, based on a great economic resource, in this case, human property, slavery, which was the greatest property in the country, in the United States, apart from all the real estate. Everything was built on slavery. And these people are proclaiming states' rights. They have a language of liberty, to be free to do what they want with slaves, with their property. And Lincoln's appalled. He's appalled at not only the slave power politically and economically, but socially. He sees in Kentucky what he calls the most ostentatious and glittering display of property in the world, of slaves trudging after their owners. You know, it's like people who flaunt their wealth in the most outrageous way in order to demonstrate how powerful they are.
Well, boy, that has echoes of a certain president in the White House, I must say.
Yeah, well, it's a politics and it's a culture of privilege. And it creates one of, you know, aspiration of envy, and there's a kind of faux populism to it. And at the same time, you know, it inculcated despair about democracy. The most influential book that Lincoln reads in this whole period is called Sociology for the South. Here's the subtitle: The Failure of Free Society. Mm-hmm. And this book, by George Fitzhugh, who was one of the descendants of one of the first families of Virginia, was in praise of oligarchy in the United States and openly against democracy. It said there would be a, you know, harmony as long as the owners of the slaves prevailed. and that democracy created a lowering of standards, and that the Declaration of Independence itself, with its precept, all men are created equal, was the falsest idea in the world. So this was everything Lincoln disagreed with and provided a kind of a blueprint for his argument against the growing slave power.
And, of course, the Republican Party has yet to be created. When we talk about the period that you were just describing, 1849, the slave pro-slave movement taking over Kentucky and the kind of amalgam of plutocrats and know-nothings, unfortunately, that is pretty much the description of the Republican Party today. And we, on the other side, the Democrats, have yet to find their Abraham Lincoln. Is that a worthwhile analogy?
Well, the Financial Times has a phrase in it called Pluto populism, and that's kind of what Lincoln faced in his day in the slave power. It was a kind of Pluto populism. Even those who didn't have slaves in the South would defend the system. They aspired to have slaves. And Lincoln was a Whig. That was the party of Lincoln. It's a party we know very little about today. But it was an incoherent party that blew apart once the issue of slavery came to the forefront and couldn't be suppressed. And the northern and southern wings of the party separated. And Lincoln was sort of left in the center on a raft. And there were all sorts of movements, and somewhat similar to today. There was a huge anti-immigration movement in the Know-Nothings, and they formed a political party. They called themselves the American Party, and their slogan was "Americans only shall govern America." Lincoln really had to navigate these political rapids. He was adamantly opposed to nativism and the anti-immigrant movement, but he never said anything publicly. It was all private. His private letters are scathing about the Know-Nothings. I mean, he just thinks they're as bad as the slaveholders. But he wants to, they're so powerful, and they include so many former Whigs. He's thinking about how to build an anti-slavery coalition, and it requires the destruction of parts of these other movements in order to bring their adherents into this other anti-slavery coalition. It's a very difficult politics he has to conduct, a lot of it behind the scenes, and using political operatives in various campaigns in different cities and elections to try and defeat the Know-Nothings particularly.
But if you're to look at the United States back then, and you've described the two forces that he fought against, the pro-slavery and the Know-Nothings, so you've got greed and inhumanity on the one hand and ignorance, xenophobia on the other. And then we certainly have a lot of that at the moment. But then there's there is that part of America even then, and as there is today, that's moral, that's decent, that's looking for the better angels. So that is ultimately the direction that he takes. And of course, one of the questions that I certainly have at the moment is, you know, when are the better angels going to emerge? You know, we just witnessed the Comey hearings, where a man who most reasonable people think is telling the truth is up against a man who is accusing him of being a liar. So we're at a crossroads here, in effect, in terms of our politics. And it's very hard to reach the people who support Donald Trump. They're in their own world because he's basically said, I tell the truth and I fulfill my promises. And anything you read in the New York Times or the mainstream media is fake news. So there's a polarization not over slavery, but in effect over the very moral nature of our country now, and it appears that there was at the moment we're talking about back in the early 1850s.
Well, here's the thing for Lincoln. Lincoln believed that slavery was a moral issue. He also thought it was a constitutional issue, and he thought it was a political issue. He always made the moral case against slavery. He said he was naturally anti-slavery, and he was. His parents, who were poor dirt farmers from Kentucky, who fled Kentucky because it was a slave state and went across the Ohio River into Indiana, a free state, where they thought they'd have more opportunity as poor white people, you know, were anti-slavery. And Lincoln inherited that sense. Lincoln would say slave states are states for poor white people to remove from. So it's an interesting perspective. But he also says moral slavery is wrong, 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 and wrong. He's most aroused against the Southern theologians who cite the Bible in favor of slavery. He regards them with the greatest contempt and wants to refute all of their arguments. But he also understands that what's required is a politics. That and this is complicated, and it has bearing today, too. Merely making a moral argument is insufficient. Proving that someone is morally shameful simply doesn't achieve your goal. Lincoln believes in politics. And the whole abolitionist movement, Lincoln was not an abolitionist, by the way, although he was anti-slavery, was a very particular movement that was riven with factionalism of people who believed simply in moralism, in wasn't even a politics, just in shaming the Southerners. There were people who believed in developing third parties, the Liberty Party, the Free Soil Party. This was the beginning of anti-slavery politics. And all that, these streams joined together eventually in the Republican Party. And Lincoln's, eventually tries to create this coalition that leads to the Republican Party. He's a party man. He knows that you need a political party to win and achieve your objectives. And he's a very canny person. He's calculating, and at the same time has a core principle. So he's a very unusual person, but he's just the person that the Illinois abolitionists believe could be most effective in helping them create a vehicle against slavery. And they come to him. Initially, he rebuffs them, and finally, he joins them. And he helps bring together this large coalition of people who often don't get along and have a lot of antagonisms and a lot of baggage from their past. They're anti-slavery Democrats, anti-slavery Whigs who've run against each other. They have long antagonisms. He tries to bring in some of the nativists, if they can understand that slavery is a more important issue. He brings in all these abolitionists who are, some of whom are, believe in high moralism and don't get along with a lot of these party people. So it's very volatile. It's a combustible mix, and it's not dissimilar from, the difficulties of creating a coalition today.
Well, but there had, beyond the moral issues against slavery, there had to be some kind of pragmatism, surely, because in a sense, I've always been puzzled by the notion that what slavery was in the South was it involved, and certainly the Civil War involved, a bunch of poor white Southerners fighting for the plantation owner's right to replace them with slaves. And that seems to me to be still, the idea that people vote against their own interests, the idea that the Tea Party support Trump, but he has a plutocratic agenda and doesn't give a damn about them. So surely there was that notion, was there?
That's the conundrum and the imponderable question today of why do people still support Trump who are working class people?
Right.
Why would you support this, lying, plutocrat?
But back then, why would you support the plantation owners? I mean, in 1852, you've got Pierce's Secretary of War essentially running the show, Jefferson Davis. The political winds are against Lincoln.
Tremendously. And the reason people supported slavery, who were poor white, was that that was the society they grew up in. The United States, in this period, was a polarized and divided country in many, many ways. Not only did the churches divide into northern and southern parts, so that, you know, all the, you know, like the Methodists and the Presbyterians, they all split before the Civil War. But northern society was very different from southern society. The northern United States was the most literate, educated society on earth. It had the greatest number of newspapers, far more than Britain, far more. You know, we're talking about 90-plus, easily, literacy in the North. Common schools everywhere, public schools, a whole new movement. This is an educated population of ordinary people. In the South, almost no public schools, no taxation to support public schools, vast illiteracy, and these are different societies, and you had a plantation elite ruling over masses of poor whites and a large population of slaves, millions of slaves.
Well, just in closing, though, Sidney Blumenthal, back to Lincoln's sort of awakening in 1855, where he borrowed from the Bible and talked about the perils of a house divided against itself, asking, can we as a nation continue together permanently forever, half slave and half free? And I mentioned earlier that can we as a nation today survive with no consensus on what is real and what is true, half educated and half ignorant? And you've just told us how much more educated the North was than the South. So just in closing, how does that analogy stand up?
Well, the polarization led to greater conflict, and eventually it came to a head. And Lincoln says in his House Divided speech of 1858, this is 2 years before his election as president in 1860, which precipitated secession, and within months, in 1861, the beginning of the Civil War, Lincoln says, "I don't expect the House to fall, but I do expect it'll become all one thing or all the other." Well, the House did fall, and that is the only way it became all one thing or all the other. And Trump is an accelerator of polarization, driving the question to whether the United States will be all one thing or all the other. And in the meantime, the conflict and the divisions become deeper and sharper, as they did in the 1850s, which is the political crisis that Lincoln faced.
Well, Sidney Blumenthal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sidney Blumenthal, the former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. He's been a national staff reporter for The Washington Post, Washington editor and staff writer for The New Yorker, and his books include the best-selling The Clinton Wars, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, and The Permanent Campaign. And among his films, he was the executive producer of the Academy Award and Emmy-winning Taxi to the Dark Side, and his latest book just out is Wrestling with His Angel, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 2, 1849 to 1856. This is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.